was dim by comparison. Its first stretch was populated with shacks built in a circle around a central pillar, venting smoke into the boughs above. Soft talk and singing filtered through the shutters. Dante adopted the alert boredom of a sentry, glancing from one shack to the next as he and Somba headed across the loft. The buildings ceased, replaced by manicured branches sagging with lorbells. Bins of rainwater lined the edges of the flat. Clotheslines crisscrossed the air. Dante had the impression the spire had once stood alone, but as the city grew, the sacred space had been carved up for mundane use. A series of posts bisected the flat, connected by gut-high ropes, preserving a bit of that space from further encroachment. Across 80 feet of empty flat, the spire of the earths waited in the night. The flat ceased just beyond it. Dante glanced back, confirming they were alone, crossed over the ropes, and walked into the shadow of the tower. The door was barred, padlocked. Dante could have struck it in half with his sword, but the noise would have wrapped across the entire loft. Instead, he poured nether into the metal, heating it. As it began to glow, he wrapped it in a ball of black nether. As soon as the metal grew soft, he drew his bone sword through it. The chain fell apart with a clink. Inside, the stones and the stairs were suggestions of matter in a chamber as dark and void as a dreamless sleep. Dante edged his way to the staircase, clinging tight to the railing, and headed to the top floor, where there was no canopy to interrupt the moonlight slicing through the glass windows. It glinted on the silver flecks and stripes of the fragment of rock. It was a rough cube about a foot to a side. Dante picked it up, grunting, and turned it over. He intended to take a 4-inch cube from the bottom. Once he had his piece, he could draw a layer of stone back across the gap, sealing it up. The minister would notice the locks had been broken, but when he came to ensure his prize was safe, he wouldn't see a single thing amiss. Dante brought the nether winging from the corners of the room. A cool glow surrounded the block. Dante moved inside it like a knife. As soon as he touched it, blinding green light surged across the room. Chapter 30. Blaze's heart leapt.
The clan's sure? They saw my target?
People who fit the description?
Yes,
the Norran woman said.
Is the clan sure these people are your people?
Of course not.
They've sent scouts after the men to see what they can learn.
Do you know Wild Sign?
Afraid my chief neglected to teach me that one.
She stood. Then I'll go with you.
What? Just like that?
You made us free. If it's in my power, it's yours.
I don't know how to put this. They're on horseback, right? And, well, you're a little big for conventional horses. Josin Joe has seen fit to provide me with a replacement.
Sitting on the bed, she stuck out her legs and waggled her feet. He couldn't help laughing.
Then show us the way.
Her name was Aldi, and after a brief stop at her shack on the east end of town, they were on the road, riding or jogging amid the smell of pines and dew.
All right, Min declared once Dolandon lay behind them. Is one of you going to tell me what just happened? How did she find out where Kinnevan is?
Blaze shrugged.
Magic. And who is Josin Joe?
Norran god, like a Rorn and a couple of his buddies rolled into one.
Min drew back her head.
She didn't actually speak to him, Wildy said. Don't you speak to your gods?
Daily. That's why we had to look for the help of a complete stranger to take us into the wilderness.
This is merely the biggest secret in Norrandom.
Blaze said. As far as I know, anyway. The way they keep secrets, I wouldn't be surprised to learn each one of them is actually two tiny people stuffed inside a giant person suit.
Aldi looked at him sidelong. We're not.
Good to know.
Blaze turned back to Min.
You should probably pretend you didn't see any of this.
Min shifted in the saddle.
Sounds like home.
Aldi wouldn't have been able to keep up with a full gallop, but her long strides easily matched the horse's trot. They sped through the evergreens, covering the border of the Norrin territories, miles playing out behind them, resting every 2 or 3 hours. After some 20 miles, Aldi left the road and jogged east through the woods, a thin layer of pine needles coating the ground. The afternoon dwindled. Abruptly, the woods gave out, and they entered a rhythmic stretch of low hills and tall grass, trees lining the streams winding through the up-and-down land. The Norrin territories encompassed a vast swath between Narashtivik and Totonin, covering topographies of all sorts. But when Blaze thought of the homes of the clans, he always imagined these undulating hills. They continued until twilight, stopping with just enough daylight left to toss up a lean-to and rub down the horses. Aldi took a long breather, sitting on a rock, while Blaze and Min tended to camp. But the Norrin didn't look done in. If true, Blaze thought they would reach the lands of the Clan of the Splitting Sky early the next morning. Aldi checked in through the loon. The Splitting Sky's scouts had located the party from Setevan, and were shadowing them from a couple miles away. According to her, Kinnevan's people had been heading east all day. Blaze and company had made up significant ground, however. If they continued to press, they might catch up in 2 days. Blaze poked at the half-assed fire he'd built. Do the scouts have any idea what Kinnevan might be after?
Nope,
Aldi said. In fact, they had the same question for you. Something stupendously old. Possibly a book, also old. Or an artifact. So they might possibly be after a thing.
Blaze sighed. Hey, it's remarkable I've gotten this close. Tell the Splitting Sky to be careful. These men are extremely dangerous.
Aldi got a twinkle in her eye.
Should I reconsider my role as your guide?
Just get us close. Min and I will take it from there.
The days were starting to grow longer, but even after a good night's rest, Blaze was up and about before the sun. They got a quick start, traveling due east into the hills. When the horses flagged, Min was able to restore some of their stamina, allowing them to gain extra miles on the king's nethermancers. During rests, Blaze practiced shadow walking. He was able to do it at will, but discovered that unless he leaned on the nether of the Kelevert, he couldn't sustain it for long. After a minute, two at most, the starlit world began to fade, disgorging him back into the real, which always looked disappointing and tame by comparison. The first time he did this in front of Aldi, she gasped. He reappeared, grinning sheepishly.
Sorry about that. Should have warned you.
She laughed.
I should have expected you're able to puff away like a blown-out candle. You're Blaze Buckler.
It was a quiet day, but a productive one. When they made camp and Aldi checked in with the scouts, she determined their group was well inside Splitting Sky territory and that they had more than halved the distance between them and Kinnevan. This was good news, in that they might be able to catch up the very next day, but it raised the question of what exactly Blaze ought to do once Kinnevan was in striking range. Sneak up on them in the night and kill them all? Not out of the question, what with the shadow walking, but it was an inelegant solution. Additionally, the main reason they'd been able to close on the king's men so fast was that the other group was zigzagging across the hills, hunting for something. If they went missing, Modigan could simply send a second group to snatch up the mystery object.
Blaze would have to stake out the region for weeks or months to make sure any other efforts met the same fate as the first. Frankly, that was a shit solution. The only way to do this was to let them find whatever they were after, then take it away from them. In the event the item turned out not to be a tangible object held in hands, but rather knowledge stored in the sponge of the brain, then Blaze was going to have to be tasked with some unpleasant business. But at the very least, knowing the source of the information should allow him to cut it off, putting Modigan's scheme to bed for good. They got off to their usual early start, trotting eastward. Deer watched from the ridges, then continued their crusade against the year's first grass shoots. By early afternoon, Aldi scheduled a rendezvous with the clan scouts. They walked down to the spot, a glen between two hills with a sluggish creek flowing from an oval pond. They'd no sooner stopped by the pond shore when two Norrin men walked out of the trees. "Aldi," the shorter one said. Shorter being entirely relative, he was at least 6 inches taller and 100 pounds heavier than Blaze. Aldi nodded.
"You said you had news."
"Late this morning, the humans disappeared inside a hill. Galt is still waiting for them to emerge." He sat down on the bank of the pond, resting his elbows on his knees. "That's it," Blaze said. The Norrin didn't look up. "Until Galt comes back." "I suppose I shouldn't complain about being forced to take a break for once." He found a rock that was dry and sunny, and plunked down. After a while, the short Norrin volunteered that his name was Otis, and asked how their trip had been. Blaze loosened the collar of his cloak. "Uneventful. Have the humans caused you any trouble?"
"Since the day they were born," Otis said.
"These specific ones, they've done no harm. In the last 3 days. That we have seen." Blaze hid his smile. Norrin pedantry. That was the end of the conversation. An hour later, leaves rustled up the slope. A Norrin woman walked from the trees and sat beside them.
"They came out of the caves an hour ago, made camp nearby."
She related directions, and the unnamed man got up to go keep an eye on the place. Galt cleared her throat and went on.
"Interesting things. First 6 men went in, 5 men came out."
"Lost one to the caves," Blaze said.
"Too bad the underworld didn't try a little harder. What's inside?"
"We're not completely sure."
He raised a brow. "I thought a clan knew every leaf and pebble of its domain." Galt gave him a long look.
"I will ignore the fact that is impossible, as new leaves are growing every day. In the sense that we might be expected to know every semi-permanent feature of our territory, I would agree this is unusual. My best guess is they discovered an old catacomb."
"A Norrin one?"
"I can hardly believe it myself. What would a Norrin tomb be doing in the Norrin territories?"
Blaze suppressed a sigh.
"I thought your people tossed your dead on the tops of hills." "These days," Galt said, "but not in the old days. Maybe we ran out of ground to put them in. We're very large, after all. In any event, our burial practices changed a long time ago. We don't care where every last catacomb might be."
Min folded her arms. It was chilly, and their blood had grown sluggish as they'd waited for Galt.
"You said there were interesting things, plural."
"When the men got outside, they ran from the entrance, then stopped in the trees to gather themselves. One man withdrew an object from his cloak, the size of a fist on top of another fist. A statue, I thought. It was as black as nothing. But when a shaft of sunlight struck it, it glittered like the stars."
Blaze whacked his thigh and laughed.
I have never heard a more gravid description of a precious artifact. Are they on their way back to Setevan already?
Galt nodded.
Before making camp, they put the cavern miles behind them.
Heading west? Then we've got to hit them tonight.
You're sure they've got what they came for? Min said.
No, they rudely declined to fill me in on that one.
It sure sounds like it, though.
And if they make it back to Dolandon, they're on a boat back to the palace and we're left holding our nether regions.
Will you need help? Galt said.
Blaze grinned lopsidedly.
Would you offer it? These people serve a land that enslaved us for centuries. Also, we probably ought to be upset that they've just looted one of our graves.
The best way for you to help will be to make sure they don't go anywhere. Min and I will handle the theft ourselves.
If Galt had been human, she likely would have taken offense to the implication that she'd be no use to the strike itself. But Noranigos were a less truculent beast.
Galt nodded, as if Blaze's assessment were a matter of fact, or at least that it was his mistake to make.
Everyone understood implicitly that they'd be moving under cover of darkness, so they all sat around the pond, absorbing the sunlight. They got a minor scare when the other scout came back to tell them the men were on the move, but Kinnevan's band was just making use of the remaining afternoon to get a few miles closer to the river. They had found their prize, and were taking it home. Blaze still hadn't glimpsed the king's men himself.
Otis told him they were all dressed in the same anonymous travel garb, but that the man who'd been carrying the sparkling object had hair as white as a swan's wing.
They ate a cold dinner, waiting for the sun to depart so they could get on the move.
Galt had departed to keep a direct eye on the king's sorcerers. Around 10 o'clock, Otis left to spell her.
When Galt came back, she informed Blaze the king's men had gone to bed 3 hours earlier. They'd left one man on watch, but according to her, the others were sleeping
like people who have eaten so much it's all they can do.
It didn't much matter, not when Blaze intended to shadow walk right up to Kinnevan and snatch his trophy.
The men were set up in a grove of trees, straddling a stream between hills.
Galt showed Blaze and Min the way. After a brief hike, she stopped to point out the sentry.
The quarter moon was hidden behind a scudding layer of clouds, and at first, Blaze couldn't make out the sentry at all. Then a silhouette rose and paced in a circle, likely to keep himself awake.
The man was undoubtedly a sorcerer. So even though Blaze was about to render himself invisible, he backed off to approach the camp from the side that wasn't being watched.
He had already warned Galt about he and Min's upcoming disappearance, and that, if anything happened in the camp, the Noran should clear out and give the men a wide berth until they'd left the clan's territory. With his implication the clan wouldn't be able to handle it, a hooded look had come over Galt's eyes.
That was how you offended the Noran ego. But she had agreed.
He and Min crouched down behind a screen of shrubs.
There were no lights in the camp, and it was too dark and tree-addled to see anyone. But he heard a horse snort.
He drew a cut on his arm, the nether a little tug. As it rebounded back to its home in the interstices, Blaze followed it in.
The night shifted. It was as dark as ever, yet he could now see the dew on the grass, the gopher mounds pimpling the ground.
Beside him, a luminescence flooded over Min as she joined him in the nether.
Together, they rose and walked toward the camp.
They weren't entirely removed from the physical world, but their feet whisked through the grass more softly than the first stir of a breeze.
The trees enclosed them, leafless and reaching.
His eyes were drawn to the birds roosting in the branches, then to the horses tied away from the men.
In living bodies, the nether nested so densely it fairly glowed.
or exactly the opposite, it was hard to say. In either event, it drew the eye. The men lay in their bedrolls, breathing evenly. One of them slept on his back with his hair draped like a banner over the rolled-up clothes that made up his pillow. His hair looked pale, but walking in the shadows made color do funny things. Blaze faded back into the world for a moment. The man's hair was white. Blaze half expected him to have the relic clutched in his hands or wrapped up in the clothes beneath his head, but in the half-second he was out of the shadows, Blaze spotted a small bag beside the sleeping Kinnevan. Something had fallen halfway out of it. A black lobe of matter. A carving or statue. Flecks of silver spat back the starlight. Kinnevan must have been holding it as he went to sleep, and it had fallen off his chest. Blaze ducked back into the shadows. He allowed himself a grin. For once in his silly life, his plans were going easier than expected. He glanced at Min, then back at Kinnevan, whose eyes were now wide open. Blaze froze, Min likewise. Kinnevan wasn't moving, aside from the even rise and fall of his chest. Yet Blaze felt motion in the nether. A presence, prowling, stealthy. He had the distinct impression that if he moved, it would lock on him. At that point, however hard he tried to stay out of sight, he may as well be hopping up and down on one foot, waving a flaming brand over his head while blowing into a trumpet with every orifice capable of producing wind. The presence circled, silent, leaving no trace behind. He thought he could see it, a dark wedge of forceful awareness sussing through the shadows. But maybe that was a trick of his want to see it, like staring down a dark hall until you're certain there's a silhouette looming at the other end. The feeling drew closer and closer, cold and heavy, like a lump of steel being pushed across a tablecloth. Its chill touched his cheek and moved past his shoulder. Kinnevan's eyes remained open, unblinking, staring unfixedly at the stars beyond the bare branches. Blaze had been under for a couple of minutes, and he felt his hold on the nether slipping. The exact way the sweat on his aching hands would cause him to lose his grip on a ledge. As furtively as he knew how, he wormed his consciousness into the calavert shell in his pouch, and tapped the darkness in it. His hold steadied. Kinnevan's probings moved further and further away. A minute later they snapped off. He closed his eyes. Beside Blaze, Min tensed, about to move, he gave the tiniest shake of his head. Across the camp the nether rippled like a fin of a trout stirring the water. The presence blinked to life beside it, but the ripple had been nothing. An ant dying of a sting. A moth eaten by a bat, something like that. It watched for another moment, then faded. Kinnevan let a long breath out through his nose. His eyelids slid shut. So far the Kelevert had continued to amplify Blaze's supply of nether, allowing him to hang on, but he didn't know how much longer this would last. He gritted his teeth and edged up to Kinnevan, who'd been so focused on feeling out the disturbance in the nether that he seemed not to have noticed the bag had slipped from his grasp. Blaze pinched the mouth of the sack and hoisted it up. Green light flashed from inside. Blaze cinched it shut and stood stock still, uncertain whether the light had been real light or if it, like so much of what he was presently seeing, was merely a product of the shadow world. Min stared across the camp. The sentry was walking briskly back toward them. Blaze turned and ran, slipping smoothly through the shadows. He felt, more than he heard, Min following. They were out of the grove and running across the grass when Blaze felt his hold faltering again. But there had been no shouts, no lanterns blooming through the branches. Aldi and Galt had retreated to rendezvous on the other side of a nearby ridge. Blaze had just enough strength to keep himself in the other world until he and Min climbed the hill and spilled down the other side. As soon as he let go of the shadows, his legs went out from under him too, spilling him into the dirt. He held tight to the bag. Min materialized beside him.
"Are you hurt?"
Blaze tried to get up, but his legs wouldn't hold any tension.
"My legs appear to have rebelled, victoriously." "Did you run yourself dry?"
He nodded. Something was rustling the grass below, closing on them. Galt and Aldi materialized from the darkness. Blaze couldn't stand, let alone run, but he was happy enough for Aldi to carry him on her back, his arms wrapped around her muscular neck. After a half mile, she let him down so Galt could take him instead, but his strength had returned enough to jog beside them. Back at camp, their horses and two other Norren scouts waited peacefully. It was only then that Blaze withdrew the item from the bag. It was carved of heavy black stone, a humanoid figure with blunt, oversized hands and feet.
"It's Yona," Aldi said, turning it in her hand. "See the many arrows?"
Blaze took it and held it inches from his nose.
"Those look like an eagle's claw, as carved by a very drunk person who's never seen an eagle."
"What's a Yona?" Min said. Aldi gestured to the wilds.
"A Norren hero. She was the one who found the Black Star."
Blaze and Min exchanged a sidelong glance.
"And what did she do with it?" Blaze said.
"Put a stop to a drought. Would you like to hear the story?"
"Another time. We need to be on the move before Kinnevan discovers it's been purloined."
He held it out to Galt. "This is Splitting Sky territory. Seems like this ought to be returned to you. Gotta warn you, Kinnevan might be able to follow it."
Galt shook her head. "It means nothing to my people, and the craftsmanship is a disgrace. Look at the proportions of the limbs."
Blaze chuffed with laughter. "Let me guess, your Nulla is sculpting."
"I've been doing better work since I was 8 years old."
"Then I'll be happy to bear it away, which I should do right now." He met the eyes of each Norren.
"Thank you all. It might not look like much, but I think we just screwed Modigan, but good."
Galt smiled smugly. Otis nodded in satisfaction. The clansmen turned and walked into the hills. Blaze smiled at Aldi.
"I hate to take advantage of your help and run, but there's one more thing I've got to go take care of."
He raised his eyebrows at Min.
"Assuming you're up for it."
Min nodded.
"I've come this far."
Aldi glanced between them.
"I'm happy to continue on with you, to help however I can."
"Your devotion to me is as admirable as it is proper. But we're heading back to human lands, and we'll need to stay as innocuous as possible."
If she was hurt, she hid it well. She hugged them both.
Blaze and Min mounted their horses and headed northeast.
He'd only known Aldi a few days, yet he missed her as soon as they'd parted ways.
Throughout his life, he'd left so many people behind that this sudden feeling of missing felt foreign, almost wrong.
Disproportionate, too.
He glanced at Min and frowned. She lifted her brows.
"Ready to tell me where we're riding off to in the middle of the night this time?"
"Oh, that," Blaze said, smoothing his expression. "We're just off to put a stop to another mad sorcerer. Fortunately, I'm much better acquainted with this one."
"Your friend? How do you know he's after Selin?"
"Because when I got to the pocket, he didn't come after me. He turned around and went home." She scrunched up her mouth.
"Maybe that's because he knew he would have been up against the entire people of the pocket. It would have been hopeless."
"We don't believe in hopeless. If we did, we would have died 10 times over at this point. He would have tried something, unless something else called him away. Something much bigger."
Doesn't he run a whole city?
Well, yeah, Blaze admitted. But he's got an army of nethermancers, politicians, monks, and bureaucrats to handle that.
She laughed. It was a tired laugh, but it didn't sound like she was upset about being tired.
I suppose I've come with you this far.
So, what do we do next? Figure out the idol's connection to Selen?
No need. We'll just find Dante.
Who could be anywhere?
We can find him wherever he is, Blaze said. The best part is I'm going to use his own damn tricks against him.
They slept in the middle of nowhere. With no idea whether Kinnevan would be on their heels, they woke earlier than it was reasonable or sane and pressed on. 2 days later, they'd seen nothing more than deer and a few Norrin. Min had examined the statue, but other than it being made from a quite fetching variety of stone, she was unable to make heads or tails of it. He didn't let her look at it for long. It could be dangerous, and they weren't trying to run down Selen. All Blaze wanted was to keep the Black Star from being found until it faded from the world again. Then everyone could get back to their boring, everyday rivalries and treacheries. He made a single detour along the path to Narashtavik, swerving north from the road to climb a mountain near the coast. There, he hiked up to Knife Wound Lake, a gash-like valley between two peaks. Its glacier-fed waters were lightning blue around the edges, but in its middle, the lake became a navy blue that verged on black. Blaze scrabbled up the side of a cliff overlooking it, reared back, and flung the idol so hard he staggered on the momentum of his follow-through and almost fell in after it. The statue soared through the air, plummeted into the water with a blooping spume, and was gone. He wasn't worried about Kinnevan tracking it down. If the Nethermancer was capable of that, he would already be upon Blaze. Anyway, unless the sorcerer had a freshwater dolphin familiar, there would be no getting it out of the lake. Blaze had immediately ruled out carrying it around, too. That sounded like a brilliant way to accidentally deliver it to Dante. They returned to the road and trotted straight to Narashtavik. A couple miles outside the city, Blaze broke from the path and circled to the north, coming to a stop inside a stand of trees at the base of a high hill. As the horses cropped the grass, he headed into the city to buy enough travel fare to last a couple weeks. He was mildly annoyed his funds were starting to run low again, but easy come, easy go. Well, after dark, he led Min around the hill to an entrance in its front. The tunnels inside were pitch black. The smell of decay wafted from its depths.
"We're going inside that," Min said. "On purpose?"
"Just passing through."
Inside, he found a lit lantern, then walked down a tunnel, staring hard at its walls. The spot was unnaturally smoothed, but Blaze knocked on it anyway, and was rewarded with a hollow thud. He stepped back.
"Open this up, would you?"
"You mean the rock wall?"
"Please." She shook her head, squaring herself to the space. The rock flowed away.
As it revealed the passage behind it, Min's eyebrows lifted.
"Dare I ask what's in there?"
"Nothing, I hope." The tunnel through the rock smelled dusty but sterile, sealed away where not even the animals could get in. The lantern swung in his hand, sending light reeling up and down the close walls. After a long walk, it dead-ended in a flat wall. Blaze gestured at it with a flourish.
"Encore?"
Min raised her hand, fingers spread, and the stone spread too. It opened into a dungeon cell, currently, and thankfully, unoccupied.
"Wait here," Blaze said. "I won't be but 10 minutes."
"What is this place?"
"Home,"
he shrugged. The cell, being unused, was unlocked. The dungeon's odors were unpleasant but stale. Nice to see Narashtavik hadn't filled the cells in his absence.
He jogged up the steps through another couple basements. At ground level, he stopped to get himself bleeding and access the Kelevert. He stepped into the shadows and opened the door to the Citadel's main floor. A liminal glow surrounded everything, dazzling and intense. Far brighter than the Netherworld had ever been before. Like diving into a pool of stars, it was free-floating nether, he guessed. Brought into the keep by hundreds of years and hundreds of nethermancers, much of which, when summoned, wound up unused, and bled back into the surroundings where it stayed. As he ran up the stairs, he shielded his eyes, but that was no help. He exited at the top floor. It was late, and no one was in the hall. He strode to Dante's room. Blaze knocked softly, then pressed his ear to the smooth-worn wooden door. No sound. The door was locked. Blaze sighed. Dante must have been afraid someone would bust in and steal his dead rats or his toenail collection or what have you. Well, he'd been right. Blaze materialized and got out his collection of metal strips and pins. Once upon a time, anticipating he might someday need to break into Callie's room or Ollivander's, he'd spent many free hours picking the locks on this floor. He sprung Dante's easily. The inside smelled a little musty, but also familiar. It smelled like Dante, of course, the same way every home smells like its owner, a smell you can only detect after you've left it behind. The Citadel had servants aplenty, but Dante's room showed no signs of being cleaned in his absence. He'd probably ordered the staff not to touch anything. Blaze grinned and strolled across the room to the basket under Dante's desk. It was filled with white rags blotched with rusty stains. Better safe than sorry. Blaze pocketed four of them, poked his head into the hall to ensure it was clear, and Shadow walked back to the basement prison. With men frowning at him in confusion, he produced a rag and snapped it open, letting it dangle from his fingers. Don't worry, it's just blood. That poor thing is always cutting himself. Care to lead me to him?
Chapter 31
Dante fell away from the stone, blocking his face with his hands. The flash was already gone. The after-image flickered in his vision. He blinked it away.
What, Somber said, was that?
The Nether.
Like Lou said. We should have anticipated this.
Somber climbed over the benches on which the rocks rested and moved to the window, where he went still.
Better hurry.
He sounded amused.
Why?
For a couple of seconds, Dante could do nothing but stare at him, so vexed by Somber's attitude that he was unable to act.
Somber glanced back at him. We have been noticed. Are you going to take the stone, or should we run away?
This didn't sound rhetorical. It jarred Dante from his stupor. Fearful that a second effort would cause the stone to flash again, he coated the windows with a pad of nether, blocking them. He reached into the stone. Its silver flecks pulsed green, but the light was very faint, hardly enough to see. Dante withdrew a 4-inch cube of rock, then told the main stone to ooze itself over the hole he'd created, sealing it. He wrapped his cube in a handkerchief and secured it inside his cloak, feeling its weight against his chest. He moved to the windows and withdrew their shadowy covers. His eyes had recovered from the flash. Down on the flat, two silhouettes watched from behind the rope barrier. Servants. Soldiers would have come to investigate. After a moment, one turned away while the other remained. He withdrew from the window.
We have to get out of here.
Shall I strike our witness dead? Somber said. If no one sees us emerge, we will appear to be nothing more than two troopers who came to investigate.
It sounded like it would work, but there was no sense murdering the servant until they were ready to step outside. Dante headed down the stairs as fast yet quietly as he could. On the ground floor, he peeked out the window. The person had been joined by two more. Iron glinted. One was a soldier. The servant was pointing at the top of the tower, gesticulating.
"Murder won't do after all," Samba muttered. "What has the world come to?"
The front door faced the flat. They had no way to get outside without being seen. They might try to conceal themselves within a shadow sphere, but its pure blackness would be obvious against the backdrop of the tower and the trees. As Dante ran down their options, another pair of soldiers joined the observers.
Samba turned to him.
"We've reached the point where a bad idea now is better than a good idea later.
So, what's your bad idea?
Kill everyone, then make a break for it.
The alternative is to hide here until they go away.
The minister will know the flash means someone was tampering with the stone. He'll tear this place apart for signs of the culprit."
"So we murder, then?"
He took another look out the window.
"I don't see what else."
He whirled. A couple of years ago, on a week-long tour to better understand the city he'd soon be taking charge of, he'd visited dozens of local industries. Among these was a glassworks, a hellish yet beautiful place of heat and flame. Dante had never known how glass was made and was amazed to learn it was nothing more than melted sand. He ran to the window at the back of the spire. Outside, the flat continued for 10 feet before stopping abruptly, its edge bordered by a waist-high railing. Dante plunged his mind into the nether in the glass. It failed to move. He redoubled his focus, willing it to go fluid, to remember that it was nothing more than earth, no different than the rock or the mud. Outside, voices approached the tower. He felt Somber gathering the nether beside him. With a soft glurp, the window parted like warm taffy. Dante tapped Somber's shoulder and heaved himself onto the sill. He lowered his feet to the flat, giving Somber a hand down, then willed the glass back together. The window was clearer and cleaner than the others, but it was intact, and they'd gotten outside with hardly a whisper. Dante crouched and scuttled to the edge of the flat. There were no scaffolds beneath it, but a tangle of lesser branches projected from the lower flats. The closest was about 5 feet below them, and as thick as his calf. Not much room for error. A chain clanked from the other side of the tower. He was out of time. He flipped around and lowered himself from the edge. As he stretched his legs into the abyss, towing for purchase on the branch, a light struck the first floor windows. His feet made contact. He bent his knees, lowering his weight to the branch. It sagged a fraction of an inch, and Dante tore one hand away from the flat's edge, waving about for balance. He made the worst transition. That heart-stopping moment when he had to release the flat with his left hand in order to be able to reach the branch he was standing on. Then sat and straddled it. Beside him, Samba finished the same maneuver. They were sitting on the upper extension of a long branch, protruding from the side of a flat below the one they'd just left. They were a good 40 feet away from its surface. Above them, people spoke, back and forth. A face stuck from the edge of the flat, eyes white. The man glanced to either side, then withdrew. Dante scooted down the branch. Leaves shook at its ends, but their rustle blended with the breeze. The flat they were approaching sported a number of buildings half hidden by the foliage. Populated, but he saw no current movement. He continued down, lifting his legs over the forks of smaller branches. Twigs scraped his face. By the time the branch connected to the side of the flat, it was as thick as his waist. The surface of the flat was 3 feet above him. He got his feet under him and stood for a peek. Seeing no one, he hauled himself up and rolled over the ledge. Samba followed him up. Still disguised as soldiers, they ought to be in the clear. Samba turned in a circle, orienting himself to the trunk.
Dante held up a hand.
Just a minute.
He transferred his vision to the squirrel he'd left inside the Spire of the Earths. It was on the ground floor. Light flickered from the top of the tower. He moved the squirrel up the steps to the floor below it. Above, three figures stood in the circular light of a lantern, the minister and his two nethermancers, the man and the woman who'd watched over the man when he went to speak to Lou in the cell.
"Block the stairs," the minister was saying. "Nobody leaves or enters the top loft until we've questioned everyone here."
"Everyone?" the woman said. "You mean everyone who could have provoked the stone into flashing?"
He stepped up to her face.
"What did I say?"
She glanced to the other man for support. He offered none. She lowered her eyes.
"Everyone."
"Then unless everyone has agreed to a new definition of everyone that I'm not privy to, I want you to question everyone. If you feel they are lying, or being in any way less than forthright, you are authorized to enhance your questions with whatever means necessary to deliver satisfactory answers. Understood?"
The two nodded in unison. The minister smiled. Dante ordered the squirrel to lie flat on the step, then dropped all connection to it.
"Time to go."
They hustled toward the trunk and got on the staircase, passing a couple of soldiers bound for the uppermost flats. The system of three bridges hadn't yet been shut down. As they waited for the last set of steps to be lowered into place, Dante heard footsteps above them. The stairs clicked down. Dante forced himself not to run across. He glanced over his shoulder. Above, the two nethermancers reached the sentries at the top of the checkpoint. Dante hurried down the stairs, dropping from sight behind the curve of the giant trunk. All the way down, with the stone inside his cloak bouncing against his chest, he expected to be shouted at, stopped, assaulted. But they reached the roots without exchanging a single word with another person. On the ground, they headed west until the trees screened them from the palatial Lauren, then hooked south through the forest toward their own. From the lowest flat, C and Ast watched them approach, confirmed their identities, and scrabbled down the roots. Dante patted his cloak.
"We got it. Ready to move?"
"Almost," C said. "Left the food up top. Bears, you know."
Dante climbed up to the round to help bring down the food. They had rifled Lou's gear for anything that might reveal him as being from Narashtavik, but were leaving most of it behind. It was unlikely to be found soon, let alone connected to Lou, but on the off chance it was, it would reinforce his story about coming back to Spiron alone. Despite that, and the fact they already had as much as they could carry, it felt wrong to leave his things there, in this hostile country. Halfway down the roots, Dante turned back to the round and pored through Lou's possessions until he found a talisman he'd seen Lou wearing earlier on their venture into Wesley, a tiny steel cat dangling from a broken chain. It would have been easy enough to fix, but Lou must have been too involved in his work to get to it. Dante didn't know why the monk had carried it or what it signified, but he intended to bring it home. Narashtavik, the city Lou's death had saved. He climbed back down and headed west. The woods were dark and quiet. After a half mile, C piped up.
"Run into any trouble up there?"
"What do you think?" Dante said.
"Then I'm glad to hear you outfoxed it."
"I don't think the minister noticed I'd altered the stone, but he knows we're from Garsk. He's canny enough to suspect why we're here. We can't stop until our legs quit on us."
Ast hadn't quite deciphered the maps, but he had a good guess as to what part of the Wodens they'd covered. Anyway, their exact course didn't matter yet. What mattered was getting to the mountains, and those were impossible to miss. They walked overland, avoiding the roads. Just in case the stone in the Spire of the Earths was being actively monitored by the minister's nethermancers,
Dante left his piece of it untouched. To be on the safe side, he didn't call on the Nether at all, and didn't intend to again until they were a safe distance from Coral. Restraining himself was a challenge and a half. He was in the habit of pulling the Nether from its crevices dozens of times a day, simply to do it, flexing his mental muscles the same way a strong man might clench and unclench his stomach while walking about on his errands. That night, Dante had to stop himself from summoning the shadows on 4 different occasions. When they finally bedded down, he reminded himself not to draw on it the instant he woke up, which was also his habit. That meant no undead sentries, either, forcing them to rotate through a standard watch. Everyone was exhausted, and rousting the next person to take their turn almost led to 2 fistfights, but they made it through the night without outside attacks or any sign of the minister. They pressed on. The hills ramped toward the sky. Dante got hold of Knack, let him in on the latest developments, and asked him to find anything he could about a black mineral flecked with silver that glowed green in the presence of Nether.
"Deepstone," Knack said on the spot. "It's mentioned in some of the Council of Narastovic's earliest histories, which you really ought to read sometime, O great leader."
"Really? What's it do?"
"Not exist, as far as I knew. Thought it was mythical, but it's credited as the inspiration for the colors we wear."
"Do any of these myths that are probably actually history tell you what it does when it's in the presence of Nether?"
"Oh, it explodes violently," Knack said. "Just kidding, I don't remember, but I know where to look."
They dropped the connection so Knack could research the Deepstone. Dante walked on. While he waited to hear back, rain began to hiss on the canopy, dropping to the ground in fat dollops. Dante pulled up his hood. It would wash away their tracks, at least, but he didn't think they were being followed. If they were, it was likely through methods immune to a bit of weather. Knack got back to him a couple hours later.
"So, these accounts are horribly obscure in all senses of the word. As you said, Deepstone glows in the presence of Nether actively being used. There was one story of using it to detect the presence of enemy sorcerers, but that turned out to be a parable of the folly of hubris. The user didn't know that a stone will only glow a few times before it's saturated and has to rest."
"Is that all? It doesn't explode or get bonded to its owner, anything like that?"
"Not that I'm aware."
That was enough for Dante. Sooner or later, they would need the stone to find the exact location of Selen. That afternoon, when they paused for a rest, he walked a short distance from the others, glanced around to make sure the nearby Laurens were unpopulated, and sat down on one of their sprawling roots. Rain dripped from above. He set down the cubic stone and brought forth the Nether. At first, he just brought it nearby, the way you'd approach a stray and uncertain dog. The stone glowed, though it had none of the intensity of the flash in the spire. After a minute, with no other activity, he slitted his eyes and reached his mind inside the stone. Green washed over the tree, catching 1,000 raindrops in its glare. He held on. The glow became too faint to see in the overcast light. The Deepstone felt more or less like all high-density stone did. Maybe the adepts of Pocket Cove could feel the difference between granite and basalt, but that was too subtle for him. He moved through the Nether of the stone, exploring its boundaries. These were as hard as the edges of the stone itself, but he knew this was a trick, because this piece of rock had once been part of a much larger one. And then he felt it. Not just one signal, no singular bloom of pressure in his brain, but dozens, so intense and in so many directions he had to withdraw. He returned cautiously, but the results were the same. Very soon, he reached an awful conclusion. This piece wasn't the only fragment of the original rock. There were scores of them, and this bit was connected to them all. He explained to the others. C cocked her head. What does this mean?
Somber smiled wryly. That we don't know where it is after all.
Maybe I can block out the other signals, Dante said. Concentrate on just one.
How will you know which one?
C held up her hand. You want us involved in coming up with ideas? Then you've got to start explaining exactly how things like this work.
It's like how I followed Blaze, Dante said, exhaling. A bit of his blood pointed me toward his hole, and the feeling got stronger the closer you got.
She waited for him to nod.
Then we used the maps to get close. Once we get nearby, maybe its signal will be strong enough to separate it from the others and follow it to its precise location.
Sounds iffy. If it works, though, it's brilliant. Either way, we have no choice but to keep moving.
He was less than thrilled that it depended on so tenuous a plan. He had to remind himself that, if it weren't for him, no one from Narashtavik would have made it this far. The city would be oblivious to the threat of the minister. Unchallenged, their enemy would have found Selin, used it to split the Wodans in half, and flooded Narashtavik with its army. At most, Dante and Ollivander would have had only a few days to prepare. The city would be torn to the ground.
The following day, C stopped in her tracks and pointed into the Lorens ahead of them. The branches writhed with motion, scores of humans cutting lorbells from their thick stems and lowering them to the ground in bushels.
"Do you see?" Samba said.
Dante wiped his nose. "The human hive dismantling the trees?"
"The Lorens are so heavy with fruit, the Spirish never need to walk more than a mile to find food. These are meant for people who intend to be gone from Spiron for some time."
They watched in silence as the minister's citizens plucked fruit to feed their soldiers in the field. Were the Lorens particular to the soil and climate of the Eastern Wodans? Or would these trees someday loom over Narashtavik, casting the city's ruins in such deep shadow nothing else could grow? The ground grew sodden with rain, a recalcitrant mush of mud and leaves. Later that day, the forest floor was churned by thousands of footprints. Many of the tracks were orderly, overlapping. Dante was something of a city boy, but he'd spent enough time in the wilds during the run-up to the Chainbreaker's War to know these weren't the random steps of a loosely organized group like the Harvesters they'd spotted earlier. These were the orderly tracks of a unit, marching in formation. Whenever the going wasn't so rough that it commanded all of Dante's attention, he spent his time with the stone, trying to isolate each connective tendril from the other fragments. But it wasn't like following blood, where the direction of its owner stood out like a sign in the sky. The feelings were soft and tangled. He made little, if any, progress. Between the prairies of Cameron that had once been a desert, and the sandy wasteland that was all that remained of the forests of Moreave, it had been possible to believe that winter was done and gone. Travel had fed that sense. With no day-to-day routine, in a place where even the air felt different, Dante's instinctive tether to the turning of the seasons had been cut. His sense of impending spring was quickly exposed for the illusion it was. As soon as they climbed out of the forest of Lorens and entered the pines, the snows returned, falling in fat, wet flakes. This was disheartening in itself, but also for what it portended ahead. Before leaving the Lorens behind, they'd stuffed their packs with lorbells. To prevent them from freezing, Dante had to keep them under his blankets while he slept. For the first few nights, he woke up every time he turned in his sleep and bumped his limbs into the round, heavy fruits. With no sign of pursuit from the minister, and the snow unpleasant but not unbearable, Dante began to dream again.
it could be less than 10 days until his remaining years were extended tenfold. What would he see? Should he devote a few decades to traveling the entire world, to expand his wisdom in all spheres? Or should he try to restrict himself to Narashtivik, where he would be less likely